Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. Today, anyone can create a blog or a social network website profile using any name that says virtually anything at all. But what if that information is humiliating or false? In this hour of the show, we'll be talking with an international expert on privacy law. His name is Daniel Soloff. He's professor of law at George Washington University Law School. That's in Washington, D.C. He says that while the free flow of information on the Internet does indeed provide new opportunities for people to express themselves, there is also a dark side. Should we stop the exposure of private secrets on the Internet? Perhaps the bigger question is, can we do that? That is the subject of a book that we'll be talking about here this morning. One of the issues, a couple of the issues that he explores in his book. It's titled The Future of Reputation, Gossip, Rumor, and Privacy on the Internet. It is published by the Yale University Press. And if you're interested, you can seek it out in the bookstore or the library. Our guest writes in a number of areas, including information privacy law, cyberspace law, also law and literature. He's the author of several books, the one that I've mentioned here, one that is scheduled to come out this spring. That's Understanding Privacy. That's published by the Harvard University Press. His other books include The Digital Person, Technology and Privacy in the Information Age, and Information Privacy Law. All of those books out there, if you're interested in exploring this particular subject. And, of course, we will explore it here this morning in this part of the show. And as we do that, comments, questions from people who are listening certainly are welcome. All we ask of callers is that when you call in, you make your comments brief so that we can keep things moving along and get as many different people here in on the conversation as possible. But certainly people are welcome and invited to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. That, if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana and you're listening over the air, and it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free line. And then, of course, if you'd happen to be listening on the Internet in the United States, you can do that too. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. Professor Soloff, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Pretty good.
Well, I appreciate you joining us. Clearly, this book, the themes in this book and the questions you explore are natural extension of the other kinds of things that you've written about and that you're interested in, that you teach on. Was there, however, something in particular, something specific that started you thinking about this particular question, these questions?
Well, I guess it started when I started blogging. I mean, I had been writing about privacy for quite some time, and I started blogging back in 2005, and I really liked it. I thought it was a wonderful experience. I started getting a lot of folks reading posts and commenting to posts, and for a professor who writes articles where just a handful of people read them, it's really exciting experience to see all this attention. And I started to explore the blogosphere and explore what others were doing online, and that started to raise some of these issues to me. I started hearing about a number of instances of people being shamed and gossiped about online, and as someone who writes about privacy, I thought that this could be a major and very important privacy issue. And basically what I thought was the following, that these are really exciting technologies, the ability to use blogs and social network websites. It's really the first time that people are able to express themselves to a worldwide audience. Yeah. Before, you'd really need to have access to the mainstream media or to get on the radio or to get on national TV to be able to spread your thoughts and ideas around the world. And so it's a great thing that anybody with a computer can express themselves and be read by people on the other side of the world. On the other hand, I think that this allows for a lot more personal information to make its way online. The people putting up the information are often young. They're in high school and college. And they're not just talking about themselves, but they're talking about others. They're talking about their friends, their enemies, their families, their teachers, and classmates. So all this is getting online, and that is what I thought was going to be a major problem for privacy if this trend continues.
Yeah, and probably an important point to make is that not only is this getting online, and not only is this online and available today, but I guess as far as anybody knows, it'll be available next week and next year and 5 years from now and 10 years from now and who knows how long. So that means that through people's own efforts and sometimes through the efforts of others, an enormous database or file of personal information, some of it correct, some of it maybe not, could exist and be available to almost anyone forever?
That is a potential, yeah, that's definitely a potential possibility that if you don't remove it, and if it's online, it is potentially available forever. And it used to be the case that when people would gossip, they'd gossip offline, and they just spread oral gossip, and this would disappear over time. People would forget it. It would only stay within one's local circle of friends, or a handful of people might know about it. But now, if it's online, anybody can pull it up anywhere. So you could leave town, go somewhere else. It could be 10 years later, and someone plugs your name into a Google search, and presto, it will come right up. So not only is it potentially permanently there, trailing you around, but it also doesn't just stay local. It can actually be accessible to anybody, anywhere, unlike oral gossip, which you'd have to basically know one of the few people who actually know to be able to find that information out.
Yeah. I know that listening to this program, we have a wide range of individuals, and I think that it might well still be the case. I know it was in the past. It might still be the case that there are people who have never read a blog, who do not have one, who are not sure what that is, and people who do not have Facebook or MySpace pages. So maybe we ought to just talk about this a little bit. The idea of the blog is not quite that complicated. The idea is that you can have essentially your own page or multiple pages, a site on the net where you can put on there whatever you want. You can talk about your social life. You can talk about the movie you saw last week. You can talk about what you think about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. You can essentially do anything. And it's interactive enough so that people have the opportunity to comment on you and your life, argue with you about your opinions and so forth. And I realized that, yes, there are a lot of blogs, but was surprised by the numbers. And you have them here in the book where you talk about say in 1999, there were about 50. And now, according to a website that tracks it, there are every day 175,000 new ones. There are apparently some tens of millions of blogs now in existence. And I think I was even I was surprised by the number that we're talking about there.
Yeah, well, this is very, very popular. And basically, all it takes is an internet connection to have a blog, because there's free blogging platforms out there. For example, one is Blogger. Anyone, in a matter of about 2 or 3 minutes, can go to this website. It's now run by Google, and they can put in a few pieces of information, set up an account, and presto, they've got their own blog. And basically, a blog is like a journal. And you write entries, which the newest entry is at the top of the page, and then they're archived in, after, like, old entries are archived in the system. So basically, it's just an online journal, and it's published to the entire world. Anyone can access it on the internet, unless you lock it down with a password or restrict it. It's generally public for the world to see. And so it's very, very easy for anybody to create a blog, to do a blog, especially because there's free blogging platforms. There's also a few that you pay for, but they're relatively cheap. And in addition, there are social network websites, and this is MySpace and Facebook. These are what's called social networking sites. They're sites where anyone for free can create their own profile. And a profile is basically like a bunch of personal information about you. So you know, you might put your picture up, you put your hobbies, your likes, your dislikes, other information about you know, where are you from, where you might go to school, and who your friends are. There's a space on these for blogs. And so you can have a space where you will have journal entries where you write about, oftentimes, your life. So all these are blogs, to some extent, or basically places on the Internet where you can write journal entries and publish them to the world. There are a lot of people who write blogs on topics. So I blog at my blog, which is called Concurring Opinions, and I blog about legal issues, and my co-bloggers, I have a group of six other law professors who blog with me, and we blog about you know, various legal and political issues. But a lot of people, and especially young people, are not blogging about political issues or even politics or law or even entertainment to some extent. They're blogging about themselves. They're blogging about their friends. These are almost like a diary. Is what their blogs are about.
Yeah. And again, then to the what makes this interesting and also problematic, the how easy it is to put information on there about yourself and others, and how easy it is to circulate and how quickly things can circulate and become widespread, virtually from one side of the world to the other, and the volume of information that's available there about people, and the speed and the distance that can be covered by that information is truly mind-boggling.
Exactly, and that's I think one trend that you're seeing, and this is I think more so among young people, is to blog about their personal lives, is to use the blog as a kind of a diary. I think that's a tendency that means that you know all the gossip about people in high school, all the gossip about people in college, all the stuff that you know people might remember from their college days or high school days, which they are very glad is forgotten. Now for the generation of people growing up today is not going to be forgotten. It's going to be contained in various social network profiles and various blogs, and it's going to be much more readily available. And so this generation growing up is going to have an unprecedented amount of personal information about their lives chronicled online, something that all the generations before never really had.
Mm. Let me introduce again the guest with this hour of Focus 580, Daniel Soloff. He is an associate professor of law at the George Washington University Law School. That's in Washington, D.C. He is an internationally known expert on privacy law and writes in the areas of information privacy law and cyberspace law, among other things. He's the author of several books, including The Future of Reputation, Gossip, Rumor, and Privacy on the Internet. It's published by the Yale University Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to go on and perhaps give some examples of what we're talking about here. And I think, again, it's worth saying that on the one hand, what we're talking about here, gossip and social shaming, are not new. People have been doing that forever. People love to gossip, and when others do things that they don't like, they apply the social sanctions that are available. The thing that is different now is the ease, as we said, it's the ease with which this information can be circulated and how far it can go and how fast it can go. Let's talk about gossip. Give us an example of internet gossip and a problematic example.
Certainly. Well, there was one of the more notable cases was this case about a young woman who was working for a senator, and she started going out with a attorney who worked worked in the senator's office. And what happened was, unbeknownst to him, she was keeping a blog. And she was keeping a blog about her relationships with actually a number of men, because she was seeing a number of men. And in particular, what made the blog particularly attention-grabbing was that she described her sexual relationships in explicit detail, including her sexual relationships with this guy who she was dating. Well, when it came to light that her blog existed, basically a website called Wonkette, which is a popular political gossip blog, a link to it, this blog went, became very, very popular in it. People were starting to talk about it all over the place. The mainstream media started to cover the story. And meanwhile, the guy who she was dating, whose sexual life was chronicled in great detail on this blog, was mortified at what happened and ultimately wound up suing her for invading his privacy because of it.
So here, again, I guess the point is that we're not talking about something that is that's new or that people have never done before, but that in when people gossiped in the past, it could be localized. Maybe a few people would circulate it, but the number would be relatively small. It could still be damaging to people, but maybe it circulated among a small group of people, and then there was at least the chance that it would go away. And now what we're talking about here is much wider circulation, and again, because of the permanence of the potential permanence for information in digital form to reside somewhere and continue to be circulated somewhere, then it could be some item of gossip could never go away, or at least it would exist and it would be passed around for a long time.
Exactly, and there's actually another example that I can get into too, which is the gossip is a little less salacious, but it had some terrible effects on the person involved. It actually involved a video that he himself filmed of himself. This is someone who has become known as the Star Wars Kid. Mm-hmm. This kid in Canada, who's about 15 years old, decided to, just for fun, film himself waving around a golf ball retriever and pretending it was a lightsaber. Unfortunately, he was not particularly good gymnast or a particularly good at doing this, and so he was stumbling around and fumbling around in quite a funny, awkward way. And this is a short little video that he made, and stashed it away somewhere, but ultimately some of his tormentors found the video. They uploaded it to a video sharing site, something similar to the current site YouTube. And what happened next was that millions of people around the world start downloading this video, and it becomes this viral sensation across the internet, where thousands of websites are talking about it and mocking this kid and teasing this kid based on what he does in the video. Other people start adding special effects to it. They make the lightsabers glow. They add Star Wars music. They have the Star Wars text that opens up the movie stream across the screen in the beginning. If you do a search for Star Wars Kid on YouTube currently, you'll be able to find this video, and you'll be able to find dozens of different versions of it that people have made. And so basically, this really hurt the kid. The kid felt tremendously humiliated by this, actually dropped out of school and had to seek counseling for what happened. Because it's one thing to be teased in one school, but imagine that tens of millions, and this is literally tens of millions of people have watched this video, imagine tens of millions of people mocking you and teasing you and laughing at you. Imagine one of your most embarrassing moments, not just known to a small group of people, but known to the entire world. And also, if you do a search under his real name, you're going to pull up thousands of links to the Star Wars Kid. So imagine that you might be the most well-known thing that you've done is some silly thing you did when you were 15 years old, and that forever you're going to be known as the Star Wars kid.
Yeah, and that's one of those examples that shows that he did not intend this to happen, but he was the originator of the image. And there also have been cases, though, when people had nothing to do with the appropriation of their image. And yet still somebody got hold of it and did something with it, and then somebody else did something with it, and then somebody else did something with it, and it took off much in the same way.
Exactly. Well, there's the case of Little Fatty in China. Little Fatty is a name that the people gave him, but basically what happened is some kid is standing around somewhere, and someone, unbeknownst to him, takes his picture. And he has some, just a funny expression on his face, and he's somewhat pudgy face. And this becomes, in China, this thing where everyone starts taking his face and morphing it onto various posters, movie posters, into various pictures, and it becomes this fun game across the internet to take, and he was nicknamed Little Fatty, to take his face and stick it on all these different pictures and morph it in. And there were thousands of these things on the internet. Now, this guy didn't know any of this. And one day he's surfing the internet and he comes across it, and then he starts doing more searches and finds out that suddenly there are thousands of pictures and sites with your face on it. So that's one where he had no idea that this is the case, and this could be anybody.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, well, it could be you.
Let's link this to the next thing that you talk about in the book, and that's shaming. Maybe tell the story of the dog poop girl.
Sure. The dog poop girl was a woman who was in South Korea. She's on a subway train. She has a little dog, and the dog poops on the train, and she's in a big hurry, so she doesn't clean it up. Well, this is rather rude, and some people weren't particularly pleased about her doing this. So one person thought, we've got to do something to get her back for this, to enforce social norms. And so they snapped her photo with a cell phone camera and put it online. Well, people found out, identified her, wrote information about who she was, and soon people found out how to contact her, and they started calling her and harassing her. People all across the internet started, berating her and making nasty comments about her. They took her picture and morphed it into various other images to mock her and attack her. And as a result, she was harassed, harassed so much that she dropped out of her school to kind of escape from some of it. And basically, it illustrates a change in what can happen when it comes to shaming. In the past, people would shame each other by saying, that was bad, or saying something nasty to the person, or giving the person an angry glare, but it would be forgotten. And, people do rude things a number of times, and it's certainly fine for others to punish a person for doing something rude. However, this took it to a whole new level, because not only did the story stay in it wasn't in a small group of people. In fact, it became throughout the entire country of South Korea. Everyone was talking about this and attacking her and getting more vicious in their attacks. And then it spread beyond South Korea. In fact, it became worldwide. It was written about in the United States. The Washington Post even wrote an article about it. So this person now, forever, worldwide, will be known as the dog poop girl.
Yeah.
And I call this the digital scarlet letter. Where for a minor transgression, someone could in fact be labeled for life as a rude person.
And it's really it's remarkable how things like this, how people have used the internet to deal with grudges or slights or times when they feel that they have not been treated well. Everything from the database that waiters and waitresses have put together, listing the names of people that they thought were bad tippers and how much the bill was and how much the tip was. We have women getting together and putting on the names of guys that they dated who they thought were bad, and who essentially they're saying to other women, don't have anything to do with this guy. There just seemed to be a wide range of ways in which people have used these, in a sense, made kind of electronic bulletin boards where they have taken people and skewered them. They have pinned them, in a sense, pinned them to the bulletin board and done it in this very public way that anybody can get at.
Exactly. And it's certainly a human response to want to, you know, lash out against someone who acted rudely. And I think it's very important that, you know, people lash out against someone who did something rude, because that's how we enforce, you know, norms of courtesy and norms of decency in society. The problem is when it gets online, it transforms into something that is typically, you know, forgettable and not permanent, into something that's permanent and that could really scar a person for their entire life, which I think is disproportionate to the often relatively minor infractions. The other problem, too, is that it often spirals out of control. I mean, the Internet, to some extent, facilitates mob-like behavior in certain regards, because people can really act fast. People can communicate very, very quickly. And so there's very little time to kind of cool off, and you have all these people piling on, and one person wants to outdo the other, and so they push themselves toward greater extremes over what is a relatively minor thing, that people are outraged at what this girl did with her dog in the subway, and they weren't even there. Hmm. And they might be over in a different country. But all of a sudden they're involved, and with all these people involved, they kind of have the mob mentality of egging each other on. And so you have the thing can spiral out of control, become fairly anarchic, and also it gets very disproportionate to the kind of transgressions that are there. Plus, there's no one to really vet or hear whether or not things are true or not. I mean, it could be the case that, you know, in this bad tipper website, for example, a lot of the people were innocent. They, in fact, left a good tip. But, you know, who is to say that the thing in that database is actually true? Also, what if the server was really nasty and did terrible service? But, of course, it's the waiter or waitress writing the thing, and so they might have done terrible service, gotten a bad tip, and then they write a nasty thing about the customer, including the customer's name. That also, I think, is very problematic, because, again, there's nowhere to be heard. There's nowhere to kind of vet these claims.
Well, our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Daniel Solove. He is an internationally known expert on privacy law. He teaches at George Washington University Law School. That's in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about some of what you will find in his recent book, The Future of Reputation, Gossip, Rumor, and Privacy on the Internet. It's published by the Yale University Press. His other books include Understanding Privacy, that'll be coming out soon, from the Harvard University Press. Also, The Digital Person, Technology and Privacy in the Information Age. And also, he's done a book, Information Privacy Law. That one, I'm assuming that's a law school textbook.
Yes, the Information Privacy Law is a law school textbook, but the other books are regular books
for general
consumption.
Right. So you can look for The Future of Reputation if you're interested. And, of course, we have a couple of people here who'd like to come into the conversation, and that's certainly welcome to. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a couple of callers. First in Urbana on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a comment and kind of a position on this. I'm not really sure that I view this as a really serious problem, and the reason I say that is the information on the Internet in terms of blogs, email, information that travels back and forth tends to be organic, and it has a limited duration and of what it's considered to be valuable. The other part that I have, the other kind of issue that I have is, you know, where do you fit satirical humor into this perspective, as well as at what point in time, you know, do we say a political cartoon or somebody that got caught with their pants down is hurtful, or whether it's humorous? And these are some serious issues that nobody wants to talk about, but everybody would like to regulate them. I'd like to hear your comment on that, please.
Certainly. Well, a couple things. On the first thing you said, that, you know, the information kind of will disappear. It is true that, you know, after something gets a lot of attention and then, you know, people start moving on to something else. But still, if you take these people's names and you put in the name of the Star Wars kid, you're still going to pull up this information about him. If you put in information about the dog poop girl, you're going to pull up information about her. And likewise with the case about the guy who was blogged about in the case with the Senate attorney case. And so it is true that information will cease to be of interest to people and gradually be forgotten. That's sort of the way the human mind works. However, when it's online and it can readily pull up in a Google search, then anyone can access it. And people are increasingly doing Google searches about each other. So you want to find out about a friend or somebody else, you meet somebody, you put their name in Google, and this information is still going to come up.
I have one other point that I'd like to make. One of the things that, you know, we were talking about social networking. Well, there's the flip side of the social networking, and that's the social Darwinism that kind of takes over. In other words, these entities tend to be self-policing to a certain extent. And by that I mean that once people understand the nature of what's going on, they tend to police their own action. It's self-regulating. And to me, I'm not sure that the cure would be better than, you know, that you might want to implement would be better than the actual problem itself. And with that, I'll hang up, I guess.
Well, I think that you're right that there could be self-policing in certain instances, but there often might not be. Yes, there were people who came to the defense of the dog poop girl, for example, and said, you know, this is just too much, you know, enough's enough. But there are a lot of people who didn't come to that defense. And so, you know, it's not necessarily going to be the case that, you know, cooler, saner minds are going to win out over those who really want to go to extremes. And it takes just, you know, a group of dedicated people who are kind of really get a kick out of, you know, harassing someone online to keep pushing it. And it's not clear that you're going to get, you know, the same kind of pushback by others, especially when someone's done something that is, you know, something that is rude, like what the dog poop girl did. And with the Star Wars kid, the damage has been done, and it's hard to see what kind of a pushback people will have. People might say, well, shame on you for watching the video. Well, the video's out there. People are going to watch it. Now, I'm not one who thinks that we should have very authoritarian kinds of regulation on this, and that's what makes this problem so difficult, is that I don't think the solution is, oh, let's just ban social network websites. Let's just restrict blogs. I think that you can't do that because we value free speech. So what I think we need to do is find a balance between privacy and free speech and between people's reputations and free speech, because otherwise it just becomes a free-for-all. It just becomes whatever anyone wants to say about someone. And it might very well be that things are funny. So the Star Wars kid video was funny. People were laughing at him, and it was humorous, and it was the kind of grist for making a lot of people chuckle. On the other hand, things that are funny to one person can really be hurtful to another person. Now, not all political cartoons, as you mentioned. I mean, a lot of those deal with making a political commentary about a politician or about a public issue, and they're talking about people who are in the public spotlight. But for people like the Star Wars kid or the dog poop girl or others, these are not public officials. They're not running for public office. They are private individuals who just happen to be suddenly turned into an Internet celebrity or an Internet villain without their consent. And I think that's different, because while it gives someone a chuckle, is it worth hurting somebody over and possibly destroying their life over? I think that when it comes to political commentary, I'm very pro-free speech. And I think that, you know, if someone wants to criticize the president in a cartoon or online, let them do so. But when it comes to talking about a private figure's personal life, that I'm not so sure really contributes to the free range of ideas that we want to have free speech for. Free speech, as I see it, is about having discourse about, you know, politics and arts and culture and other things. But I don't see it extending to spreading gossip and rumor about people's private lives.
I want to get on to a couple of other callers here, but for a moment, because half of the book does indeed address the issue of how law responds to the problems that we've talked about. I would assume that would people would presume that they own their image and that unauthorized use of it would constitute a violation of the law. And certainly if, well, for example, if I called you on the telephone and we had a conversation and I recorded that without telling you, that would be against the law. What do people have any kind of a recourse? For example, the Star Wars kid, doesn't he have a right to say, well, this is I not only this is this an image of me, but I created this, and unauthorized use without my permission is a violation of law. And I suppose if he had the wherewithal to hire a lawyer, he could go after either the people who are circulating it or the platforms that they're circulating it from.
That is possible. He might be able to use the law of copyright to, because he did make the video, to try to get the video taken down. It's gone so far, so widely, that it might be very difficult for him to do so. He did sue the others who put the information up, and the case was ultimately settled, and I don't know anything about that settlement. It actually occurred in Canada. So I wasn't really able to locate information about the settlement. I think it was a confidential settlement. It is true that there are some rights that you get to control images of you. So, for example, but typically the main control is the people who make the image rather than the people to whom the image is taken. So let's say I take a photograph of you. I have copyright in the photograph, and I'm going to get a very strong legal protection for my creation, which is the photograph, because I'm the person who took it. You, the subject of the photograph, you get privacy protections. You get a protection known as appropriation of name or likeness. That protection is much more limited than my copyright protection. So as the maker of the photograph, the taker of the photograph, I get more protections than you get. The appropriation basically is the way it's been interpreted by courts, restricts the use of your image to endorse certain things. So I can't use your image and put it in an advertisement. I can't suddenly put you on a billboard, for example, advertising my product. However, I can take your picture and use it in a news story. I can use it to illustrate a certain point. And the courts have said that is not covered when it comes to appropriation. Now, one of the things I suggest in the book is that maybe we should rethink this and provide greater protections to the people to whom who are the subjects of the photographs, and that might give people a little bit more power to limit the kind of non-consensual use of their image online and in other ways. But currently, the law typically will only really give you a right against being used to hawk products or to be in an advertisement rather than much else.
Hmm. The other thing that I'm interested in having you talk about here for a second is the issue of accountability in regards to people who help to circulate the information that we're talking about. And I guess I'm thinking about, for example, if I said something bad and damaging about you and the New York Times published it, you could take action against the New York Times. But if I say something bad and damaging about you and somebody puts it on their blog, then I don't think that it's as clear that you can take action against that, against the blogger or against whoever it is that's offering the service to that blogger. It seems that it's much the idea about accountability and responsibility and liability in cyberspace that just doesn't parallel the hard print real world, at least not yet.
That's true, and that's actually a product of the law. And typically it's the case that when it comes to libel and defamation, offline, suppose you write something, a letter to the editor at your newspaper, and the newspaper publishes that letter. And they look at the letter, and let's say as before they publish the letter, they find out that, in fact, something in that letter is spreading a falsehood about another person, but they just publish it anyway. They can be liable for, even though they're not the ones who wrote it, they can be liable for printing it, publishing something of another person. Same thing if I'm selling pamphlets, let's say, and I'm told the pamphlet contains something that's libelous about somebody, I can't then keep selling the pamphlet. Now, the ordinary rule is that I'm liable for what I say, but I'm not liable for what you say. Mm-hmm. I'm only liable for what I say. But if I'm selling something that you said or spreading something that you said, I can be liable only if I have knowledge of that defamation. Now, on the Internet, there's a law called the CDA Section 230, and this law basically immunizes Internet service providers and others for the content provided by others, which is basically the way the law offline works. However, courts have read this law to also apply to immunize folks for even after they know something is defamatory. So an example would be this. Suppose I have a blog, which I do, but you decide to post a comment and it's defamatory against someone else. That person writes to me and says, hey, would you please take this down? There's a comment to one of your posts and it is defamatory. Under the law offline, once I have knowledge that that is defamatory, I would have a responsibility to take it down, or else I could be liable. But 230 immunizes me, and now I don't have to take it down. I can, in fact, say, no, I'm going to leave it up, and I don't care what you think. I don't have to do anything. I don't have to look into whether it's true or not. I'm going to leave it up there, and I'm not going to be liable. And I think that is one of the problems. Another difficulty is that a lot of people putting the information up don't have a lot of money. They're kids. And so they're not likely to be able to sue them. They might do it anonymously, so it might be hard to find out who they are. Now, you can actually, if you bring a lawsuit and you can get courts to uncover their identities, and you can often trace someone who posts something even anonymously. But even when you find them, you might find that they don't have a lot of money. And so lawyers are not going to be interested in taking those cases. Hmm. And so that really presents a big problem in the law. How do we deal with this problem when so many people putting the information up are not likely to be able to be sued? How do you deter them from doing that? And that's sort of an issue that I grapple with in the book, is 'cause we don't want, let's say, tens of thousands of lawsuits going around. Yet, on the other hand, we don't want a rule that basically says whatever is up there you can say with impunity and there's no consequence.
We have about 5 minutes left, and we have some callers and want to try to get at least one or two in the time that remains. And for anyone who has just tuned in or been in for a little bit, 5-10 minutes, I'd like to introduce again the guest, Daniel Soloff. He's Associate Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School. That's in Washington, D.C. He is an internationally known expert in privacy law and is author of the book, The Future of Reputation, Gossip, Rumor, and Privacy on the Internet. It's published by the Yale University Press. We do indeed have some callers here, and we'll go to the next in line, and that's someone in Effingham on line 4. Hello.
Thank you, David. I'm a letters to the editor writer, the subject you just mentioned, and a year ago I wrote a piece about motorcycles and automobiles. The motorcycle, which is exempt from certain laws in the state of Illinois, that you don't have to have a muffler or a windshield or any sort of child restraint and other issues. I articulated about 10 or 15 of those offenses that the motorcycle gets away with that the automobile does not, especially when it comes to child restraint and no windshield and muffler and a seat belts and all those, which are standard equipment. Well, they published the letter, which I named no names. I just published my thought, or, you know, they published my thoughts about the dichotomy between automobiles and motorcycles. And then it started. The local paper has no, the blogger does not have to give their name. They have a pen name. And I got 11 pages of negative comments, both about my name, which is not your usual Irish name, and they were all published by the bloggers who had their blog name attached to them, and one even from England. And it was, I was astounded. I was not upset, you know, and I don't, that's not part of me, but still, it told me what the Internet is like, which in the 1990s, the 60 Minutes referred to the Internet and its practice all as a sewer. I'll ring off, and thank you, David.
All right. Well, I don't know. You can comment on that any way you like.
Well, sure. I think that, first of all, what sounds like happened was, you know, people were responding, but actually responding more to the person's arguments and criticizing their arguments. And it sounds like there might have been some insults and nasty things mixed in. But at the end of the day, insults are not things that the law really redresses. You know, we don't have laws that restrict people from calling another person a jerk or an idiot or something like that. And I think that's a good thing. I think that, you know, people shouldn't be suing every time someone calls them a name. I'm concerned more about spreading false information that other people might believe about a person that could really harm a person's reputation, or spreading information about their private life that could also harm someone's reputation. I'm less concerned about just very pungent criticism that gets nasty and that gets kind of rude and crude. A lot of speech is rude and crude, and people do that, and I'm not at all, I don't think that the law should do anything to stop that. It's unfortunate that some people express themselves in that way, and the way they criticize someone is by saying something nasty and mean, but that's, I think, fair game. And I think the Internet, you're going to see all sides of speech, from the good and sort of discourse that I think is at a tremendously high level, to the bad and discourse that really is just a bunch of name-calling and is like a sewer. So I think it's not just a sewer, because there's quite a lot of good stuff online, too. It has the potential to have certain communities where people really will write nasty and horrible things. And what I'd ultimately like to see is, you know, I think that people can write whatever they want, including, you know, rude, nasty things to great things. The thing I want to prevent is from private information about people's lives getting online and damaging their reputation, or false information about people's lives getting online to damage their reputations.
Let's try and get at least one more caller. Champagne, line two. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. I just had a question. When do you think, what is the point where cyberbullying is blogging and blogging is cyberbullying? Because I see, especially on MySpace and other websites like that, that bloggers tend, especially high schoolers and, you know, young college students, tend to ream other people for no apparent reason just to release it, and it ultimately harms the other person.
Well, it's hard to figure out where the line, precise line, is going to be, because, you know, if someone blogs and says, hey, so-and-so is a jerk, you know, it's not that bad. If it's a sort of an intensive campaign of harassment that can rise to bullying, then it's something, I think, much more serious and much more extreme. One of the things, I think, that leads to this problem is that these technologies are relatively new. I think that for most people using them, their parents really don't know much about it. They don't know what their kids are doing. They don't know that their kids might be bullying other kids. And as a result, without being aware of it without even teaching proper etiquette when it comes to using the internet and blogs and social network websites. How do we expect kids to pick that up and learn about that? And so I think it's greater awareness on the part of parents and a part of educators to tell people, hey, this is really serious, and you shouldn't just be using the internet as a tool to bully and harass people. You shouldn't be spreading people's private information online. And I think currently those lessons are not being taught.
Okay, how do you propose that we... How does someone take responsibility for that besides parents and educators? Because I've seen that nobody is taking responsibility and people are getting hurt for it.
And I got to give you about a minute, Professor Sala.
Okay. Well, I think that the law can help try to create incentives to get people to become involved. I mean, if parents can be sued for things that their kids put online, that could make parents educate themselves about what is going on. I think that, but I do think that at the end of the day, there's no substitute for people becoming aware and for people teaching each other to be responsible, because we are treading in a realm where we're dealing with free speech on the other side, and so we can't go too far in the protecting of the reputation, because we don't want to chill free speech. So there's important values on both sides of the scale, and we have to be very, very careful in what we do.
Yeah. I'm sorry, we're going to have to stop with more to be said, and perhaps it's a subject we can get back to, but for the moment, I'd suggest if people want to read more on this issue, you look for the book, The Future of Reputation, Gossip, Rumor, and Privacy on the Internet. It's published by the Yale University Press by our guest, Daniel Soloff. He is Associate Professor of Law at the George Washington University Law School in Washington, D.C. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.